This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we have three scholars from St. John's College in Annapolis, and they have translated one of the earliest human writings in our history from Greek to English. It is Plato's Symposium. And our guests are Eva Brann, Peter Kakovich, and Eric Salem. And they're going to talk to you about the process of translation and what this book is. I'm going to start with Eva. Eva's a philosopher. She was trained as an archaeologist. She's the author of several books and has been teaching at St. John's for 60 years. Eva, what is Plato's Symposium and who was Plato?
Well, I'll say what a symposium is first. The word means drinking together. It's a drinking party. Usually there's a lot of wine and a flute girl. In this particular party, they decide to go easy on the wine and they send the flute girl away.
Because they're hungover from the night before, right?
Because they're hungover and because they want to have a conversation. And the conversation is going to be about love.
About love. Is this the first known exploration of love?
No.
Okay. Eva Brann is one of our translators, and Peter Kakovich is another translator. So, it is about eros and love. Peter, what's the difference?
Well, in this dialogue, love is definitely of the erotic sort. There are many kinds of love, of course, but this dialogue does focus on the sexual erotic character of love. And all of the speakers in the dialogue attempt not merely to say what it is, but to praise it.
Yes, and I have to say that this book is very clear in this discussion because many of us have read it years ago. This is the first version I have ever read that was truly enjoyable.
Well, thank you.
What is this thing called love, Peter?
Ah, well, that is the question of the dialogue.
And how many men were discussing this question at the symposium?
I don't know. Eva, do you know about how many would be at a symposium typically?
No, I don't, because many speak and many don't speak, so we don't.
And in
really
this volume, though, we have six very notable men, including Socrates.
Six great speeches.
Six great speeches,
yes. And then one woman who isn't there but who's reported.
And we'll find out about her, too. Yeah. So our scholars are Eva Brann, Peter Kakovich, and Eric Salem. Eric, take us back, hark us back into Eva's sitting room one Saturday morning a year ago or more, and you three get together and you say, we're going to do this thing. How does such a thing begin? How do you divvy it up?
Well, what we do is each person takes a turn. We usually meet once a week. That person does a roughly 30 lines of Greek per session, comes in with a rough draft of a translation, and then we sit down and just attack that translation, polishing it, going over every single line, until we've got something that sounds not like that person who did the work, but sounds like us.
Each of you have a different notion. Are there debates about words?
There are constant debates about words, often about just what flavor. Every Greek word has multiple translations. We have to decide what the right one is to capture the meaning in that particular passage.
I cannot even imagine these discussions, but how I wish they were being recorded. So we have three scholars, and they have great backgrounds in the classics. I think Peter is a musician as well and heads a St. John's chorus, author of many books. As I say, Eric is a scholar as well. Eva is a world-renowned philosopher, although she would not like me to say that. So we're going to enter into this foray and find out what these people were doing. As the third member of the group, can you parse out exactly what you did? Can you look at this book and say, wait a minute, I did that in this book?
No, I can't. Not at this point, because we've hashed it over so many times that it would be almost impossible for me to track which particular sentence I translated.
You don't have a footnote after every sentence.
No, not at all.
Eric, who wrote the introduction?
We all wrote different parts of the introduction.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And the glossary. Now, the glossary is very important, of course. What is a glossary, Peter?
A glossary is the list of Greek words with their translation that will allow the reader to see not only how we translated something, but why. In some cases, giving variants.
Why did you translate this?
This dialogue?
This symposium, yes.
There were many translations, as you can imagine,
hundreds,
of a dialogue as famous as this. We thought that having tried our hand at several dialogues before, we could bring our same brand of faithfulness to the Greek text and effort to make it as lively as possible.
Were there other translations that you felt were, that you admired?
Yes, yes. We rely on other translations all the time because we learn different things from them. In some cases, we may not admire their style, but their accuracy, their ability to capture Greek syntax is very helpful.
Eva, did you want people, a great audience, to read this? Who did you believe would be your readership?
We hoped that it would be so readable, because it's an exciting dialogue on its own, that it would have a very wide readership. In other words, not only students, our students, for instance, tend to use it for their reading, but also just people who are interested in Platonic dialogues.
But
or
what,
other people who happen to come on it.
Right, and that's the important thing. How do we come upon such a work? That's what interested me the most, because it is, people hear it and they think, they snore, you know. But now, when I read this, I can say it was the clearest, most accessible, most enjoyable piece of literature I have read this year, and I read a lot. Is that what your intention was, or was it to be boring, Eric?
No. Oh, well, it was to be boring. But no. A large part of what we did after we had our rough draft of a translation that we'd worked out was to polish it and polish it, read it aloud again and again until it was something that we thought that anybody could take in.
And as this is a poetry program, I must say that it is not only clear, but it is lyrical. It's colloquial and lyrical. How did that happen, Peter?
Well, we thought hard about the different characters who were giving these speeches and tried in large part to capture their distinctive idiom.
So set the symposium up. On the back is a schematic which shows actually the beds or couches they were lying on, leaning on their right arm or their left arm, in their togas. Eva, describe the room that these six important gentlemen were in.
Well, we had to imagine it. We don't really know. So it was a room. The furniture was mostly couches, and then tables in front of the couches on which there was food. There was bread, and there was meat, and of course then there was drink, and cups to drink with.
And this one night, though, they usually got together for these sessions, but this one night they decided not to drink. Tell us about that.
They did drink, but not. They weren't going to get drunk.
And who
decided? They all had hangovers, I think.
Who decided, let's talk about love? I wonder how that came up.
Yeah.
I wonder how that came. We'll never know, really. What year was this, Eva? 430?
16, 18?
Something like that.
Yeah. 416,
400,
416, 418. How do we know such a thing?
Because there are allusions to things that are going on, and there are arguments about it.
Okay.
And we don't much care anyhow.
Just name a few of these important personages, Eric, who were assembled there for this drinking fest. Who were some, besides Socrates, a name many people may know, name some of these philosophers.
Well, probably the second most important person, I would say, is Aristophanes. People often think of Aristophanes as the person who wrote The Clouds and therefore started Socrates on the path toward his execution. But here they are at a party together, each making speeches about love and getting along as well as people with forceful personalities can be expected to get along.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I didn't know that background.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And name another that you might enjoy.
Well, the one that I think is most important to name after Aristophanes is Agathon, the famous young poet. After all, this symposium is in honor of his having won his first contest for his tragedy. And so he's in there. He gives a very interesting, in some ways funny speech.
I loved him. because he was over the top.
Yes, he was.
And he is, he's a poet, but he's no lack of self-love there or for his art. So how does he attribute love? How does he describe love in his view, Eric?
Well,
it's all good, right?
It's all good. Love is wonderful and beautiful. It has all the virtues. And the more he talks, the more you think, God love looks an awful lot like Agathon himself. So I think it's a self-celebration more than anything else.
A little bit of a showboat, but he livens the entire book, I think. And he is very eloquent and very beautiful. And I think he believes himself.
I think he does. He's also the one who most associates love with flowers. And you see that florid character in the way he speaks. His poetry is florid.
Name another, Eva, who is one of your favorites.
Well, Phaedrus, who is very much at the beginning of the discussion and introduces the subject of love.
Was he the doctor?
No. The doctor is called Eryximachus.
And he approaches love from kind of a physical viewpoint, doesn't
thinks,
he? What does he think?
He thinks of it as therapeutic. Yes.
Filling up and of emptying.
Yes, and not only people, but nature. Yeah, he thinks that love governs nature.
Was that the first time that was introduced?
And I doubt it.
You doubt it. Yeah. But it's really the first time it's evident, I think, in such a palpable way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And give us another point of view. So we have Agathon, who is full of self-love, but very charming and lively and poetic and lyrical. And we have the doctor who approaches things physically. And who do we have then next? Aristophanes. Tell us what he says.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that Aristophanes is a comic poet, but the vision he gives us of love is tragic, really. It's that love exists because the gods got mad at human beings who were too ambitious. He split them in half, and so every human being goes through life looking for his or her other half, longing for his or her other half. And we only rarely run into anybody that we're really meant to be with.
Yes, he makes it quite arbitrary. Explain the wheel that he feels originally was one embodiment. We were all one with our body parts sticking out.
Yes.
And then what happened? They split the wheel.
Split us in half, and the threat is that if we misbehave again, he'll split us another time. So the gods will split us in half another time.
So some of us went toward men, some women went toward women, some men went toward men. What is the most controversial thing about the symposium, Eva, in your view?
Well, we read this dialogue once with a bunch of professionals, doctors, lawyers, who were not graduates of the college, and they objected to the sexual congress with children even.
Right.
So it's the homosexuality that could become controversial.
Well, Aristophanes says, man, man, woman, woman, man, woman. And then someone, one of the philosophers, introduces the idea of boy-man love, which was formalized at that time, right? Mm-hmm. And how does that, what do you mean by formalized?
I'm sorry,
do you mean by boy-man love was acceptable in certain provinces?
Well, it means essentially a child, a young adolescent, who has, as a lover, an older man.
And how does that happen? Does one submit to that? Does a mother allow
Some
that?
Parents evidently didn't mind. Other parents did mind. But the word pedagogue, which means a child leader, is really the name for a servant who accompanies a youngster to see that this kind of thing doesn't happen. So it wasn't altogether acceptable.
But the
other thing is that it was more a custom for the upper classes than for ordinary people.
As usual.
As always.
So this was not condoned in every province. It was just some places would allow that and others would not, would mandate that, right?
Yeah. And in some cities it was more common. In some of the armies were composed of homosexual
I see. So. But it is a beautiful explanation of human emotions, I believe. Eric and Peter and Eva, all tutors, which is might be called professors at other universities, you are all steeped in the classics. But in each one of you, there must have been a wish to do this. Could each of you tell me what in your heart made you want to engage on this year-long process?
Yeah, it actually was a couple of years long. I think one thing is that we had just finished translating The Statesman. It's a wonderful dialogue in its own way, but very, let's say, dry. And we thought, what would be a nice antidote to that experience? It would be to read something, translate together, and talk about for a couple of years, talk about the symposium. So that was partly behind our choice.
Then what's next?
Well, a dialogue called the Philebus. We go back into dry territory, but a really exciting theme. What's the best way of life? Is it the life of pleasure? Is it the life of thought? Is it some life that's a mixture of those two? And if so, in what proportions?
I need the answer, Eric. Right. Write it quickly.
Okay.
I do need that answer. Well, when will this begin, this project, Peter?
We've already begun it. We're only a few pages in. But as you can imagine, since we're very busy, we have to find time to meet to work on it. But we've made a good beginning.
You've taught at St. John's in Annapolis for how long?
40 years.
Eva, how long?
60.
How long, Eric?
27.
You're just a baby, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Right now, it's important to give a taste of this text. Now, this is the newest version of the oldest writings by Plato. And we're going to have it performed by Peter Kakavich and Eva Brann, our thespians for the day. Will you set up what you're going to read? I asked you to pull something out of the book, so just tell me what you wanted to read.
We'll take turns reading. I will read the first segment, which is the end. It's the peroration, or the glowing praise that comes at the end of the speech, Agathon's praise of Eros. And Agathon wants Eros to be all good and beautiful, so we get a little taste of his style. Then Eva and I will read a speech, an exchange between Diotima, a priestess, a mysterious stranger woman, whom Socrates says he once spoke to and learned about love from when he was very young. And then Eric will read some passages regarding the entrance of Alcibiades and a little bit of his speech, I guess,
so
about Socrates.
Remind the viewers that we're at the Library of Congress. We're talking to three scholars from St. John's in Annapolis, and they have translated from Greek to English, Plato's Symposium, and we're going to hear a taste of it right now.
The end of Agathon's speech. It is love, Eros, who empties us of alienation, fills us up with close relation, arranging for us to come together with one another in all such gatherings as this, in festivals, in dances, in sacrifices, proving himself our leader. Furnishing mildness, banishing wildness, kind giver of goodwill, no giver of ill, gracious, good, a vision to the wise, a marvel to the gods, envied by those who have him not, treasured by those who have a lot, father of daintiness, delicacy, luxury, graces, yearning, longing, caring for the good, uncaring for the bad, in toiling, in fearing, in longing, in speaking our very best pilot, marine, fellow soldier, and savior, adornment of both gods and humans all, leader most beautiful and best, whom every man should follow with tuneful hymn, sharing in the song love sings as he casts his spell over the thought of both gods and humans all.
That is beautiful.
And now an interchange between Socrates and Diotima that leads up to the great revelation about who love is.
And just remind us who Diotima is.
Diotima is the, I think, fictional character Socrates presents as his love teacher. And yet, love is agreed by everyone to be a great god.
Is that by all who don't know, or also by those who know?
By one and all, surely.
And how is Socrates? Would he be agreed to be a great god by those who claim that he's not even a god at all?
Who are they?
You're one, and I'm another.
How can you say that?
It's easy. Come tell me, don't you claim that all the gods are happy and beautiful? Or would you dare deny that any of the gods is both beautiful and happy?
By Zeus, not I.
So then, don't you call those who possess good and beautiful things happy?
Entirely so.
But in fact, you've agreed that through need of good and beautiful things, love desires the very things of which he is in need.
I did agree.
How then could one who has no share in beautiful and good things be a god?
In no way, as it seems.
Then do you see that you too don't regard love as a god?
Then what would love be? A mortal?
Not in the least.
But then what?
Just as before, in between mortal and immortal.
What's that, Diotima?
A great demon, Socrates, for everything demonic is between God and mortal.
Having what power?
Interpreting and transporting to gods things from humans, and to humans things from God, from the one petitions and sacrifices, from the other orders and returns for sacrifices. Being in the middle of both, it fills up the gap so that the whole itself is bound together with itself. Through it, the whole art of divination also proceeds, and the art of priests who deal with sacrifices, as well as rites and spells and all divining and wizardry. God with human does not mix, but through the demonic there occurs all intercourse and conversation of gods with humans, both when they are awake and when they are asleep. And the one who is wise in such things is a demonic man, while one who is wise about anything else in certain arts or handicrafts is mechanical. Mm. Now these demons are many and of great variety, and one of them is love.
Delicious. And before we continue with Eric's reading, could you just say a little bit about how you feel about that dialogue? It's quite wonderful. It actually reveals the logic with which the conversations proceed, and I think that's important to note.
One of the characteristics of the dialogue that appeals to me is that all the people, all the young men who precede Socrates, they talk well. Aristophanes is hilarious. But by and large, they don't say anything significant about the nature of love. They praise him, but they don't analyze him. Then comes Socrates, and everything changes. You begin to think about what it means.
And through this dialogue.
Through this dialogue.
It's seminal.
Yes.
Eric, we don't know what you've chosen, so you'll have to set it up for us.
Yes. So I'm going to read a little bit of Alcibiades' speech, or really just the introduction of Alcibiades. Alcibiades was a great Athenian figure at the time, a mastermind behind the expedition to Sicily, sort of a ill-behaved in all kinds of ways, but also full of talent, in political talents and other talents, and had a sort of peculiar relation to Socrates. And he bursts into this party just as Socrates' speech ends. So you'll hear him. I'll go ahead and read now. And not much later, they heard the voice of Alcibiades in the courtyard. He was extremely drunk and bellowing loud, asking where Agathon was, and commanding them to lead him to Agathon. Then the flute girl, who's now entered in, along with some others of his followers, propped him up and led him into their company. And he stood at the door, crowned with some sort of bushy wreath of ivy and violets, and wearing a bunch of ribbons on his head. And he said, "Greetings, gentlemen. Will you welcome as fellow drinker a man extremely and utterly drunk? Or should we only put a wreath on Agathon, which is what we came for, and then leave? For you see," he said, "I wasn't able to get to you yesterday, but now I'm here wearing ribbons to get on my head in order that from my head I might crown the head of the one I proclaim wisest and most beautiful. What? Are you going to laugh at me because I'm drunk? Fine. But even if you do laugh, I know well that what I'm saying is the truth. So tell me here and now, am I to enter on the terms stated or not? Will you drink with me or not? Then they all made an uproar and urged him to enter and lie down, and Agathon called him in. And he's in the process of sitting down. Socrates turns out to be sitting next to Agathon, and Agathon says, Alcibiades has not seen Socrates yet. And then we get this. And then Agathon said, untie Alcibiades' sandals, boys, so he may lie down in the third spot. Certainly, said Alcibiades, but who's this third fellow drinker of ours? And as he turned around, he saw Socrates, and having seen him, leapt up and said, Heracles, what's this? You, Socrates? So you were lying here waiting to ambush me again? Just your habit of showing up suddenly where I least think you'll be. Why have you come now? And another thing, why are you lying down here? You're not next to Aristophanes or someone else who gets laughs and means to. No, you scheme to lie down next to the most beautiful man in the room.
Such personalities come through. This is really an interesting, not only for its the lyrical content, but the interactions, the psychological action between the characters is what keeps, motion lotion, I call it. It's what keeps the text moving. And before we close, I want to ask each of you in turn, what you believe is the most significant thing that either you see in the text or that we should know about it?
I would say the passage that Eva and I read, the great reveal of the dialogue, is that Eros is neither mortal nor immortal, but something in between. It's very difficult to say what exactly that means, but it seems to fit the experience of erotic desire.
But Peter, do we know any more now about what Eros is and what love is? Has this guided us in any way?
I think so. I think it's shown us the insufficiency of dealing only in the extremes. I think we have to look in the middle somewhere for a being, this strange being, Eros, that we're all affected by, as somehow both needy and resourceful simultaneously, always lacking and always trying to find a way to make itself full. That sounds very true to life.
It does. And is it the desire that keeps upon wanting replenishment?
Yes.
Is that what we...
Well, it's not only replenishment, it's reproduction. It's mm-hmm. to give birth to what it is that's inside of us, in the soul.
This is the most complete understanding of that conversation, I believe, in any text. Is that right? I don't think it's been explored this thoroughly.
There is another dialogue called the Phaedrus, in which Socrates does say more about the symposium, about love. Some of it overlaps and some of it's different.
But I like these different voices. Eva, what is so important? You have taught for 60 years. And so what do you believe that you've brought to the world in this book?
Well, the people in the dialogue are some of them actual lovers, and they're together on the same, some of them are together on the same couch, some of them are across the room from each other. But all of them are friends, and this is a real discussion amongst friends. I might say that translating together as we have, how many, 20 years, for 20 years now, has the same effect. We don't usually bring wine to our meetings, but we're friends.
I understand. Eric, what do you believe is the most significant part of this, either in your contribution or in what is said?
Yeah, I guess I would say that there probably isn't a single answer about love that's given in the dialogue, but what we do get is these portraits and the different views that are put forward by the different authors, I think all add up to some kind of whole vision of love. And the task of the reader is to take in the dialogue and then think about what he's seen, what's gone on in the action, and try to arrive at his or her own understanding of what love is. So I think that's what this dialogue leaves us with.
And that's a question that will never end.
Yeah.
And it helps us so much. Finally, Eva, what is a philosopher?
You've struck me dumb.
Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah,
that's the answer. It's cleaning up messes, once you said.
Literally, it means someone who loves wisdom.
That's a great answer. We'll end on that note. Our guests have been Eva Brand, Peter Kakovich, Eric Salem, and we've been discussing Plato's Symposium, which is available right now. It's right on the bookshelves, and you will not be disappointed. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the David and Reva Logan Foundation. Additional support by Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue, and Candace Katz. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.